Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club and the chair for this evening's program. It's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, the Honorable Thomas Pickering, who is simply the most experienced and able diplomat in the United States. Ambassador Pickering attended Bowdoin College in Maine, graduating cum laude in 1953 with high honors in history. He then earned a master's degree from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He was awarded a Fulbright Fellowship and attended the University of Melbourne in Australia, where he received a second master's degree. Ambassador Pickering served on active duty in the U.S. Navy from 1956 to 1959, later serving in the Naval Reserve, where he reached the rank of lieutenant commander. His four-decade-long career in foreign service included ambassadorships in Russia, India, to the United Nations, to Israel, El Salvador, Nigeria, and Jordan. Additionally, he served as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs from 1997 to 2000. He holds the rank of Career Ambassador, a very rare and the highest rank in the U.S. Foreign Service. Following his retirement from the Foreign Service in 2001, Ambassador Pickering served as Senior Vice President for International Relations at Boeing until 2006. He is currently serving as an independent board member at the world's biggest pipe company, OAOTMK, in Moscow. He is affiliated with numerous organizations, including the International Crisis Group, and he oversees their international actions as co-chair. He's chairman of the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, chairman of the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy, and chairman of the American Academy of Diplomacy. Following his retirement, the U.S. Department of State Foreign Affairs Fellowship Program was renamed the Thomas R. Pickering Foreign Affairs Fellowship Program to honor Ambassador Pickering. In May 2004, Bowdoin awarded Pickering the Bowdoin Prize, the highest award that the college bestows upon its graduates. He serves on the board of directors for CRDF Global and the American Iranian Council, the latter an organization devoted to the normalization of relations between Iran and the United States. He's currently a member of the Constitution Project's Bipartisan Liberty and Security Committee. He's a member of the Henry L. Stimson Center Board of Directors and the Advisory Board of the Eurasia Group. Tom Pickering is a member of the Global Leadership Foundation, an organization that works to support democratic leadership, prevent and resolve conflict through mediation, and promote good governance in the form of democratic institutions, open markets, human rights, and the rule of law. It does this by making available, discreetly and in confidence, the experience of former leaders to today's national leaders. It's a not-for-profit composed of former heads of government, senior governmental and international organization officials who work closely with heads of government on governance-related questions of concern to them. In 2012, along with former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, Ambassador Pickering helped lead a State Department-sponsored panel investigating the attack on the U.S. diplomatic mission in Benghazi. He is fluent in French, Spanish, and Swahili, and has a working knowledge of Russian, Hebrew, and Arabic. In addition to an honorary doctorate that Bowdoin awarded him in 1984, Ambassador Pickering is the recipient of 12 other honorary degrees. Ambassador Pickering lives in Fairfax County, Virginia. He and his wife, who has passed away, had two children, Timothy and Margaret. Today, Ambassador Pickering will discuss a new report on detainee treatment from an independent bipartisan organization called the Constitution Project. Ambassador Pickering was a member of the Constitution Project's Blue Ribbon panel investigating this issue. Please welcome a most distinguished American diplomat, Ambassador Thomas Pickering.
Thank you, Dr. Duffy, very much for that very warm welcome and that very expansive introduction. I always have believed that just a little bit of hyperbole goes a long way, but I'm very grateful to you and thank you very much, and a little bit embarrassed, but there is always a tendency at this point to say, let's quit while we're ahead. I want to talk to you tonight about a serious and somewhat, in my view, disturbing problem in our national history, something that I think we all need to pay a great deal of attention to, and something that I hope we can find useful ways to guard against ever repeating. And this is, in effect, the use of torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment to deal with individuals who are detained both in Iraq and Afghanistan and as a result of the 9/11 attack on the United States. That's as succinctly and as clearly as I can put it. The history of this particular activity goes back to the period at the end of the Bush administration and the beginning of the Obama administration, when a number of people in Washington, including some good friends of mine, thought it was important and indeed appropriate that the government itself take a hard look, as they did at 9/11, with a Blue Ribbon Commission to deal with this issue, for a number of reasons, some of which I accept as being reasonable, including the fact that one president does not investigate the actions of a former president without serious repercussions on the office, and that indeed we have impeachment as the method of dealing with presidential misbehavior. It has a very high threshold, obviously, but it's important, I think, to maintain this. And so the Obama administration declined to take on this particular task. After a certain period, a number of us who had been associated with the Constitution Project were asked for advice and gave it, and indeed supported the idea that an independent commission composed of people from all of the trends, tendencies, and capacities should take a serious look at detainee treatment, first on the basis of the open material. We did not attempt to, nor should we have invaded the wall of classification. But we did bring together a combination of individuals as the advisory group, along with a critically valuable and important staff, in a two-year effort to look as broadly and as widely as we could at how and in what way the United States treated detainees. On Professor Brand's table is the full report, 570-some pages, covering a wide variety of topics, which I will shortly, hopefully, get back to you on terms of our findings and recommendations. Let me tell you a little bit first about how we proceeded and who we were. Who we were included a number of people well-versed in jurisprudence, a former federal judge who had also run the FBI, a diplomat, yours truly, a number of people who had intimate knowledge of the activities, two general officers in the military, one a woman, another who had been an expert in teaching interrogation. We had an ethicist from the religious community, a physician well-versed in forensics and indeed in medical ethics, among others. It was chaired, the panel, by two former congressmen, a Republican, Asa Hutchinson from Arkansas, and a Democrat, Jim Jones, and I don't know what Jim's provenance is, but it's pretty wide. Jim was former, as well, ambassador to Mexico and someone who had worked at the New York Stock Exchange. In any event, we met in an early occasion, and I looked around the room and examined the credentials and said, this is a high-powered group. How are we ever going to agree on anything? The miracle was, after 2 years of very intensive investigation, very close relationships among ourselves, and particularly with the staff, we produced this report in which we agreed on almost everything except one facet of the closure of Guantanamo Bay. And on that, two of the 12 or so members dissented. And we, of course, had of necessity to accept their dissent. But it wasn't, in my view, a seminal dissent. We proceeded by reviewing all of the literature that we could find. We conducted through the staff interviews and investigations, many with former detainees. A number of staff members, and I accompanied one of them, visited overseas countries to look into the question of CIA black sites, their location, and their treatment of individuals. And that material is in the report, some of it for the first time. We had interesting interviews with a wide variety of people, including many who dissented against the legal opinions that were then current in the government and the Bush administration, which apparently authorized some of this behavior. And overall, I believe this is perhaps, as of now, the most extensive report on the subject short of the classified information. Interestingly enough, the Senate Intelligence Committee has been conducting for several years its own review of the classified information from the Central Intelligence Agency, principally of their activities. That report is reportedly some 6,000 pages with a 300-page executive summary and a shorter set of conclusions. Senator Dianne Feinstein, who is the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, is engaged in an effort to persuade her colleagues to release as much of this report as can be released while still protecting classified questions such as sources and methods of intelligence gathering. I admire her greatly for this, and she's received some support. Interestingly enough, it would not shock and surprise you to know that the Senate Intelligence Committee is divided on party lines with respect to the release of this report. But together with our report, it would provide as succinct and as broad and as complete a summary as I think we'll see for a long time of principally what happened. Our principal effort was not to seek to prosecute. It was not to seek to hold people accountable. It was to seek to find ways to give advice and indeed recommendations to the government and to others to put as much of a roadblock as we could in this ever happening in a facile and easy way again. Admittedly, governments can always change their minds. Happily, in our government, the judicial system at least upholds the constitutional imperatives. And so we are not, in, as some countries are, totally in the thrall of an untrammeled legislature or an untrammeled presidency. I want to do two things in the time that remain with me. I want to speak to you about the recommendations and the findings, and I'll rely on a short summary, which also I think you could find from the Constitution Project if you're not interested in reading all 577 pages. The 577 pages have some fascinating information, but also I think would provide a basis of a sure cure for insomnia on some late nights if you want to indulge yourself in that direction as well. I'll try to pick and choose among the findings, and with your permission, I'll do something I normally don't do. I'll read from the report itself because I think care with respect to concision on wording is important to convey the messages that we sought to convey, and these were very carefully put together. The first finding is perhaps the most fundamental and the most important. It says that U.S. forces, in many instances, used interrogation techniques on detainees that constitute torture. American personnel conducted an even larger number of interrogations that involved cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. Both categories of actions violate U.S. laws and international treaties, treaties that we happen to be parties to. Such conduct was directly counter to values of the Constitution and of our nation. The task force believed there was no justification for a responsible government and military leaders to have allowed these lines to be crossed. Doing so damaged the standing of our nation reduced our capacity to convey moral censure when necessary, and potentially increased the danger to U.S. military personnel and indeed to others who might be taken prisoner. Democracy and torture cannot peacefully coexist in the same body politic. The task force also believes and hopes that publicly acknowledging this grave error, however belatedly, may mitigate some of the consequences and help undo some of the damage to our reputation at home and abroad. The second finding is closely connected with the first finding. It, in fact, said that the nation's senior officials, though some of their actions and failures to act in the months and years immediately following the September 11 attacks, bear ultimate responsibility for allowing and contributing to the spread of illegal and improper interrogation techniques used by some U.S. personnel on detainees in several theaters. Responsibility also falls on other government officials and certain military leaders. I won't go further into the recommendations with respect to that, except that we felt that regardless of political policy, leaders of this country should acknowledge that the authorization and the practice of torture and cruelty after September 11th was a grave error, and take steps, and this is the fundamental point, necessary to ensure that it cannot be repeated. U.S. intelligence professionals and service members need clear orders on the treatment of detainees, requiring at a minimum compliance with the gold standard here, which is common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, a standard exposition of the illegality of torture and other mistreatment. Civilian leaders and military commanders have an affirmative responsibility to ensure that their subordinates comply with the laws of war. And we felt that Congress should strengthen criminal prohibitions against torture and cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment. The third finding was there is no firm or persuasive evidence that the widespread use of harsh interrogation techniques by U.S. forces produced significant information of value. There is substantial evidence that much of the information adduced from the use of such techniques was not useful or reliable. This is a very important finding because it goes to the heart of the justification that some have used in one way or another to continue to persuade the public to support the use of this kind of treatment. And indeed, recent polling data in the United States has indicated in some of these polls that over 50% of the American public accepts and indeed supports the use of torture and harsh interrogation under some or other circumstances, something that I think needs to be looked at very, very carefully and needs to be contrasted with the statements we have made on the, put it this way, the lack of clear utility. There is no certain way, obviously, of proving a negative. And there is no certain way of assuring that either all information provided under torture is of no value. But it is very clear that methods of interrogation which are based on rapport building have been much more reliable as a result of that kind of an approach than those that have been used to provide a combination of fear and pain to produce results. In large measure, but I don't know that one can say exclusively, those under torture often use any method of falsification to relieve the pain and stress while not betraying the secrets that they harbor with respect to their own activities and those of others. And a number of people, including in the period that I'm discussing, have died under torture rather than to reveal information. The fourth finding was the one where there was some difference. The continued indefinite tension of many prisoners at Guantanamo should be addressed. Here, the majority felt that we should proceed in the following manner. Some 84 of the current 160 prisoners have already been cleared for release. The difficulty is that the circumstances that must be addressed to be met, according to the Congress, to assure their release are so stringent and so difficult that there is no easy place to which they can be released. Some recent changes in law have begun to relax this, and recently several prisoners were sent to Algeria, and perhaps more will be released. But it is a very difficult situation. But the notion that you could continue to hold detainees, where you have a positive finding for their release, in itself is an aberration that needs to be looked at. Our approach to the release of detainees was that all who can be tried must be tried in civil courts. If they cannot be tried in civil courts for good reasons, then any military commission constituted to try them should contain all of the protections and indeed all of the safeguards that are present in the civil court system. If individuals cannot be tried for one reason or another, and often that's a result of tainted evidence as a result of torture, then we believe the next effort should be to find places to send them overseas, but with some assurance that they will not be tortured. Similarly, if no country is willing to receive them, we should give some consideration to returning them to countries of their citizenship or nationality against the same kind of assurances. And obviously, we need to be careful with respect to that. In the end, we felt that if that set of processes could not be proceeded with, we ought to get the Congress to do everything it can to take away the prohibition on their being incarcerated in the future in the United States. We see no reason why U.S. courts and U.S. Prisons are not adequate to deal with these people. And finally, we felt that there ought to be a process similar to that followed by people being detained for immigration violations of constant review of their status, with the idea in mind that at some point we can find an appropriate place to which they should be sent. And this would result in the closure of Guantanamo. My colleagues who dissented only dissented on the basis that they should still be kept at Guantanamo and not brought to the United States. I don't know that that was a fundamental issue, but it was there. I think that among the other recommendations we made and findings was we needed to work more closely with our friends and allies to have a common approach to this question. We paid particular attention to legal findings and recommendations, including finding that the lawyers in the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel gave what we thought were erroneous legal sanctions to certain activities that amounted to torture and cruel and inhuman and degrading punishment. We also felt that it was the view of the task force that we had violated international legal obligations in our practice of enforced disappearances and arbitrary detention of terrorist suspects in secret prisons abroad. This is essentially the rendition question. We found that diplomatic assurances given when individuals were returned to foreign countries in this process against torture were valueless or nearly valueless. And we should take, for example, as the standard for judging whether people would be subjected to that kind of activity, at least as a basis, the State Department human rights reports on the activities of countries in these areas. We found that officials involved with detention in so-called black sites also committed acts of torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. We found that the medical profession was co-opted, indeed perhaps impressed by the military in particular, in seeking to find ways to explain that torture really wasn't torture because doctors observed it. We also had a clear case where psychologists recommended using the kind of treatment we use to prepare pilots, would they be captured against cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment as the basis for deciding what was torture and not torture, which was clearly a violation of our treaty commitments and U.S. statute? We felt that ethical principles and conduct arrangements for U.S. physicians were violated in this process, and they should not be involved in monitor or indeed be co-opted in any way in this kind of treatment. I think that we finally felt that the reports of the Defense Department on the number of detainees who had been released, who once again returned to the battle against us, if I can phrase it that way, were probably too loosely based and too subjective criteria, and were, in our view, overestimated. And that figures that represented recidivism below 5% were probably much more likely than the figures which approached 25% in their reports. There are many other pieces of this. I've about used up my time and then some. I just wanted you to have a clear sense of what this report produced and what its recommendations were. And how much of an aberration it was, I believe, in our own national approach to life and the principles and indeed the values we hold dear. One cannot obviously ignore the fundamental principles that underpin the United States, its policies, and its actions in an effort to try to deal even with huge national crises without suffering some damage. We have seen that in terms of attitudes toward the United States. Even more importantly, military officers with knowledge have testified clearly that much of what we did in this particular set of issues has served as a recruiting tool for those who want to enlist people in the fight against us. I'd be happy now to address questions and clearly appreciate all of you surviving the suspension of BART, if I could phrase it that way, to come and be with us tonight. Thank you.
Our thanks to Thomas Pickering, former U.S. Undersecretary of State, former Ambassador to the United Nations, and member of the Constitution Project's Blue Ribbon Panel on Detainee Treatment. I'm Jeffrey Brand, former dean, professor, and director of the Center for Law and Global Justice at the University of San Francisco School of Law, and I'll be moderating with great honor tonight's audience question period. The audience questioning will last for 25 or 30 minutes, and let's get started. As usual, the audience has provided a host of questions that cover wonderful topics that deserve our consideration. Let me just say as an introductory thought, I mean, it seems to me that with regard to the report, there really are three areas that are highlighted. One is too much secrecy, lack of institutional controls, and the need to amend our laws. And I hope we can look at those different topics, but also look at broader questions that those topics raise about our government and our society. And of course, with Ambassador Pickering's incredible background, there are all kinds of topics that we could discuss in international relations, some of which have found their way to the questions that are spread out in front of me right now. Maybe the starting point, somebody just simply stated, how do you define torture? And maybe that's a good place just to begin the conversation.
Yeah, and I assumed we might get this. There is in the report, and I'll refer to you, and if I could find it immediately to hand, and I know I can't, I don't want to waste your time looking at it, a fairly concise definition that relates, in fact, to the treaty definitions that have been prepared that we have signed on and the statutory definitions. So I think there's no lack of coherence about what the definitions are, and I think there's no lack of coherence as to where the red lines are. I think that there were efforts made As I noted in my earlier statement, in the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department, which is the definitive place in which interpretations of statutes is lodged in the U.S. government, under Professor Yu and others, to find a way to seek to define torture in ways that permitted a wide variety of excursions from the established definitions. And as a result of that, the report, in fact, calls their actions acrobatic in their efforts to avoid staying with the definitions. And I think that that's important. And so forgive me for not having ready to hand this concise definition, but it is in the reports and it is in the statutes. And I believe that if you're interested to pursue that, the World Wide Web will help you.
Great. And I think that is a fair starting point. But I think there's another interesting starting point here, which is the task force itself. First of all, I want to disabuse you of the notion that the report causes insomnia. It absolutely does not. I've read a good chunk of it, and it's a remarkable history, and one that I would hope that as many people in this country read as possible. It's particularly interesting that even the history of the Obama administration is detailed in ways that I think anybody that picks up the report will find enlightening. And, Ambassador, I think we all owe you a debt of gratitude.
I want to say, Professor Brand, I said it didn't cause insomnia. It might cure insomnia.
Oh, a cure. I stand corrected. Move to strike clause. But let me talk about the task force with you for a moment. What struck me looking at the members of the task force was that there were psychiatrists, there were theologians, there were military people, there were diplomats, of course, lawyers. What does the breadth of the task force say about the impact of this topic and the committing of torture on our society?
You know, it's a great question. My own sense is that from whatever perspective you come at this, most Americans who at least are versed and educated in the subject see torture as an abomination. That's why it is so disturbing to me that people are responding to polls, and I haven't seen the polling question. Often there is an art in confecting polling questions that somehow can skew the purpose, but that's why I'm wondering why, in effect, this is the case. One of the things we looked at particularly was whether torture produced any useful information in locating Osama bin Laden. And it was very clear from our review that that was not the case. We went as far as we could go, despite the fact that some well-known films have intended to at least convey the impression that that was the case, and this was perfectly splendid stuff. And I think that that's why people were willing to come together, and perhaps why it was possible for us to reach very positive and indeed unanimous conclusions on almost everything we consulted on.
And there are actually a couple of questions here about Zero Dark 30. Mm-hmm. And one questioner even made it even more serious because it was Zero Dark 40.
Okay,
but
yeah.
Hopefully things are... Yeah. But I do want to talk about something you just alluded to about, and that is our character. One member in the audience writes, as a great oversimplification, as Americans, we have a great tradition of believing we are perpetual good guys, but the good guys don't torture. How can we regain the high ground? And my thought about that as well was, you cited the poll where over 50% in one poll actually supported torture. The report cites a poll where 25% thought that waterboarding was okay. And Susan Sontag, I think in one of the great pieces after Abu Ghraib, had a sentence that I think is one of the most poignant sentences that I've ever heard, which is, It's four words. The photos are us. And I'm wondering what, in light of that question and all of the polls and Sontagian kind of observations, what does all this say about our national character?
I think it's important to recognize that war does things to people. It cannot help but doing so. It is a life and death struggle, even if you're behind the lines. And there is something cruel, inhuman, degrading, in every sense of the word, about military combat. And I think that and the emotion of war are things that catch hold. I think that people do things that they would rather not either admit or want to be responsible for at a time of conflict, in part because then the system appeared to encourage or at least release the restrictions on what they were doing, that it's perfectly okay. Two Marine generals, General Krulak and General Hoar, wrote an interesting piece and said, once this approach starts, it drops through the chain of command like a stone. And it is certainly a situation in which, even if it is characterized as very unusual circumstances, it becomes a practice. And particularly if the victim of torture resists, and you have some sense that torture is the perfect arrangement for extracting the truth, then the frustration grows. And I think one sees every play of human emotion in this particular set of issues. It's not in any way to excuse it, but it is to give you the fact that a set of circumstances, if not carefully controlled, particularly in the military, as I said earlier, by those responsible for supervising the effort, then you can see where it takes loose. And we know that in past wars, people have obviously violated the laws of war at one time or another. And we know, in fact, that that's an enormously difficult question to control. And we have seen in recent conflicts. I think that we are getting better at it. But this was an excursion heavily justified by 9/11, by the outrage of the American public, but being attacked at home, and by losing 3,000 people in the blink of an eye. And I think that that itself added dimensions to this particular issue. And it was very clear that inside the government, there was a deep, deep continuing concern for a period of long years that there would be another attack and that the government would be found culpable, that the government would not survive another attack of this character on us. And as a result, they said, do what you have to do to prevent another attack, a very benign statement which opened the door to the kind of activities that we now have to contend with. And we will have very difficult problems to meet. Just one short story. I was ambassador to Israel between 85 and 88, and somewhere along in about 1986, there was an attack on an Israeli civilian bus by Palestinian armed guerrillas. Many people were killed. The treatment of the captured guerrillas, two or three were captured, was brutal. There was deep concern in Israel that they had planned another attack. And indeed, this was reviewed by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court of Israel at that time said, in exceptional circumstances where you have the potential for another attack, you can use forceful methods without any definition. This opened the door. And if you've seen the movie The Gatekeepers, six former heads of the Israeli Domestic Intelligence Agency, what we know as Shin Bet, what is better known in Israel as Shabak, testified to the bootlessness of this particular issue. And it was not until 12 years later, under Chief Justice Barak in Israel, that they ruled out the use of force under any circumstances. But they've had trouble, obviously, enforcing it because once the door is opened, it's very hard to close. But I think their experience, even in extreme circumstances, and they certainly face this kind of question in a much more carefully extended way than we do, is a perfect example of how and in what way you have to come to grips with the notion of how you preserve your fundamental values, while at the same time how you contest with an enemy who is presumably not restricted in that sense.
Thank you for that. Speaking of the military, one of the sentences in the report that struck me and is actually in contradistinction to the a question that I have here about how can we get the military to abide by international law, a question from the audience, a fair question. But in the report, you say the strongest barrier to a return to torture and cruel treatment may be the military. Yes. And I think to many out there in our listening audience and also in our audience here in San Francisco, that may be a counterintuitive comment. Could you please discuss?
I think our military emphasizes and places high value on discipline, on adherence and following orders, on an effort to continue to inculcate what their responsibilities are under various situations. And you cannot have a military in which, in fact, the freelancing and individual uncontrolled operation is the order of the day. It is life-threatening in every sense of the word, both to the individuals concerned and maybe to others who share the battlefield with them. And I think that it is important, therefore, to recognize that one of the principal tenets of the American military is discipline, good order, and conduct that in some ways is perhaps much more responsive to that kind of approach than almost any other group that we have to field. I think the intelligence agencies are responsive. They sometimes have freelancing and sometimes have people who are less responsive, but it is the duty of everybody with responsibility to ensure that criminal conduct does not become the order of the day in their organization. And they know and understand it destroys faith in the organization as well as their ability to operate successfully and with full respect to the safety of the people they're engaged with. Yeah.
That's fascinating. And it does remind me that right after Abu Ghraib, the Nation magazine ran almost an entire issue. The headline of the cover was "The Revolt of the Military," and it was about the military's grave concerns about what was happening at Abu Ghraib. I want to talk a little bit, if I may, about accountability. First of all, you made a comment that obviously it was not the commission's job to prosecute or even to assign responsibility for any wrongdoing that might have occurred. But you also indicated that presidents don't do that against their former presidents, and I'm probably misusing your words, but that it was counterproductive or not likely. But I'm wondering in this case if the Obama administration didn't miss an opportunity by having the Attorney General consider seriously prosecutions, because that would have been consistent with something else that's very eloquent in the report about the need to atone, to come to grips with, to confront as a country what has happened over the last decade.
I think that it's right in a sense that our attitude toward our role was not necessarily in any way to influence the administration against their own responsibilities in dealing with these questions. I think that they have to speak for themselves on those responsibilities and will have to answer those questions at some point. I'm not at this point prepared to speak for them and don't have the authority to do so. So my feeling is that responsibility lies in several areas. It lies with respect to the people who purported to provide the legal authority. Responsibility lies with respect to the people who ignored those senior government lawyers, both in uniform and out of uniform, who wrote dissenting memoranda to their chiefs with respect to what was going on. It also lies in a somewhat perhaps perverse way to the question of illegal orders. Mm-hmm. Coming out of Nuremberg, it was very clear the precedent was established that orders could not establish authority for illegal actions. And therefore, soldiers, officers had to be trained to understand what was legal and what was illegal, and not comply with illegal orders. A very difficult and testing proposition for someone whose principal concern on the battlefield is preserving his own life. But nevertheless, that's the burden we lay on them, and those are the kinds of questions that have to be addressed, and indeed they need to be looked at. There are clearly deep concerns in the military and in the intelligence establishment that if we go about prosecuting individuals, it will destroy morale, weaken the confidence they have in their own system, and particularly when they believe they were either deceived or misled in terms of what was permissible. And these are difficult problems. They raise real moral controversies for all of us. I'm not so sure, however, that we shouldn't at least have a very serious Justice Department investigation of these activities, if only to establish that things are prosecutable or not prosecutable, and then the decision would be made by the Attorney General as to whether to go ahead, and political and other factors could be considered. But I do think we need something from the central government to say, in effect, whatever we decide to do with respect to prosecutions, these were errors. We will take steps, whatever they may be. We recommended many to guard against their ever happening again. That is, in my view, the minimum requirement we face as a country to make sure that presidents do not, in fact, at the heat of the moment, make a set of decisions which result in calamity.
I appreciate that straightforward answer. Thank you. I want to remind our listening audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Thomas Pickering, former U.S. Undersecretary of State and former ambassador to the United Nations, who is discussing his involvement in a new report critical of the U.S. government's treatment of detainees and enemy combatants. You can also find videos of Commonwealth Club programs online at fora.tv. Ambassador, if I may, I'd like to just pursue the accountability train just a little bit further. We have two, I think, actually very poignant questions kind of posing opposite sides of the coin. One says, and first of all, I want to preface this by saying that you're statement about Article III courts, which are our federal district courts, of course, a very eloquent plea for the use of the courts and for due process. But one questioner asks, how is it that people that commit minor violations or relatively minor violations pay a price, but people that commit, and I'll paraphrase here, actions that are on, quote, a grand scale and with such deleterious impact on our nation and the world, may not pay a price. On the other side, I don't know, I don't want to pit two people against each other, but just in terms of the question, why should detainees be afforded all the benefits of the U.S. legal system when they and their colleagues neither respect our system nor indeed, well, that's the drift of it.
Sure.
So I leave it to you to help.
Well, I think the second part of the question is fairly straightforward. Do we reduce ourselves to the lowest common denominator of our enemy, or do we respect our values and principles and provide in our justice system a single standard of justice that applies to all, something that we would want? It isn't limited to citizens alone. When aliens get in trouble in this country, they have the same rights. I would suspect that I would be taken to task if I said the immigration courts practiced all of the rights and defenses that we would like to see from the criminal and civil court system. I think we fall down a little bit there, but let me still answer that question on that basis. And I don't see any need to avoid that. I think that our justice system is based on the fact that a preponderance of evidence has established the facts, and they lead to conclusions about what should be, in fact, the punishment or the result. And I would not want to see us abandon that. I'm not sure the other side of the question is quite so clear to me in terms of what that questioner wanted a response to.
Okay, fair enough. There's a lot of concern in the audience, excuse me, and I'm sure, sorry. There's a lot of concern in the audience and also I'm sure in the viewing audience about what's happening now. Before I get to those specific questions, I want to talk to you about your notion of the need for less secrecy and more transparency. Why is that such a problem? But I want to also tack on to that this question. If it is such a problem, are the Snowdens and the Assanges a necessary component of a vibrant democracy?
It's a very good question. I'm not sure one that I would find easy to squirm out of. I think that in many ways, the justification of whistleblowing runs up against what are the obligations of people who receive classified information. And to some extent, you accept a special responsibility in receiving classified information. That responsibility, in my view, in fact, carries with it something of the notion that you have to do everything you can to rebut and change abuses from inside the system. And most systems have ways of doing that. Not all of them are perfect. But I think that that has some special status to it. I'm not sure, in fact, that we shouldn't find more ways. But I doubt that this will happen as a result of Snowden and Assange to build in to our classified systems a greater sense of what I would call ombudsmanship. But I think that's the way in which at least I would go for the first effort. I think that in life and death situations, obviously, there may be a bigger prevailing requirement. I'd like to say two other things, if I can, in response to the question on transparency. One is that I think it would be a serious mistake to allow the notion that the respect for the classification of sources and methods can apply to this kind of treatment. It is not a source and method of collecting intelligence. It never should be. It is too uncertain, too variable, and too unpredictable to rely upon. And it is a kind of travesty that we have applied classification to these issues. Secondly, I think that the Senate report, the 300-page summary document, ought to be produced. I have no objection to one producing the report along with the edits and indeed those statements and documents from inside the intelligence establishment as if they can be released as to why things should be edited out. Their objections ought to be public on this, and they ought to be part of the justification for the cutting of the report one way or another. But I think the American public is owed that. That is the logical counterpart to what we have done in a wide way to do interviews and to do a review of unclassified information. And indeed, one of the reasons why senators who don't want to release the report are objecting is that they never did interviews. There was just a document survey. Well, you know, we can provide some of that, but it does seem to me that that's not an inadequacy. It may be a shortcoming that in one way or another can be remedied by later work if we didn't do it all.
Thank you. I think this may be overstating it, but I think the events of the last 6 to 8 weeks with the NSA indicate that the only thing we know maybe is what we don't know. I mean, in the sense that we know that there's a lot out there that we just don't know. And there's a lot of concern in the audience here for what is happening now. What's happening at black sites? Do they exist? What's happening at Guantanamo? One of the report's recommendations, very powerfully stated, is to not rely on diplomatic assurances of a receiving nation that a detainee is going to be treated with respect. What do we know about what's going on now?
What we do know is that black sites have been shut down by executive order, that the executive has ordered no more torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading punishment. In terms of Common Article 3, which is incorporated in the Army Field Manual, we have some reservations about the Army Field Manual because a number of treatments that were prohibited have been removed in a recent amendment of that, and we'd like to see some of those restored, things having to do with sleep deprivation as a treatment. I think that, of course, rendition is still going ahead. Abu Anas al-Libi was taken in Libya a few weeks ago. I'm very pleased to see that he's been produced for federal court in New York, an Article III district court, for trial. And I think that that was very helpful, that he was not sent to Guantanamo. In Guantanamo, 160 prisoners remain. Of them, 84, according to the latest count, are approved for release by the United States under stringent review criteria. My own view is that some of the remaining 60 may be releasable, but I would like to see us close Guantanamo. It was set up originally because some clever legal folks thought that it would not be in the jurisdiction of the United States, and happily the Supreme Court decided it was. And I think that wherever we have preponderant control, we have jurisdiction. And I think that that's hopeful. I mean, I myself would think that early closure of Guantanamo is still in order, but we now have to go through the process, which I think is going to be excruciatingly difficult, of undoing the legislation which boxes us into using Guantanamo.
Well, that actually dovetails with questions that have been asked specifically about Guantanamo, including your opinion as to whether you think it will be closed. And secondly, there were questions related to that, that again, the report, this is a wonderful report to read, really. And it speaks about the issue of recidivism and whether or not we have any real information as to whether those being held now are in fact going to leave Guantanamo and engage in some kind of activity that would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. So in addition to will Guantanamo be closed, if we don't know, as the report seems to indicate, about whether somebody will be a recidivist, should we hold that person anyway?
Well, I think that I would hope Guantanamo is closed shortly. I don't think it will happen from where we have seen things. I think on recidivism, I don't know that there is any meter, any basis for judgment, any interview process that can give you a clear indication or not. Some of these detainees, when released, are subject to trial and future incarceration in places to which they're released because they've committed crimes that are prosecutable there. And I believe that that's a guard against recidivism. The record is checkered that one set of criteria has produced a fairly high number. another set of criteria by a prominent non-governmental organization that studied the issue has produced a much lower figure for recidivism. I think that one looks at our own criminal justice system. How successful are we at finding a basis for the retention of people on the supposition that they will commit further crimes if they're released? And would you, as someone incarcerated fairly and squarely or otherwise, want to be judged by that same standard, whatever it is? And I think so. We, in effect, can't, I think, apply a double standard here with long-term success. And so it's a combination of detention without trial, endless detention with no clear review process, no standards that at this point seem to be doable for release, and a deep concern. And I have to say that in our own justice system, unfortunately, we often convict people who are not murderers, and we often let people go in our justice system who are murderers, and we take our chance with that every day, unfortunately. But I'm not sure, in fact, that we ought to apply a different standard. If you know these guys are so bad, then the evidence on which you have come to that conclusion ought to be produced. And if it can be produced in unclassified form, fine. But if it cannot be produced in unclassified, we have a classified procedures procedure for our federal court system, which protects the information and which at the same time gives the individuals an opportunity to appear at trial with the due rights protections, including the clearance of their lawyers, so that the process can take place not in a star chamber proceeding, but in a closed proceeding in which, obviously, one hopes that the question of justice can prevail rather than endless detention.
Thank you. You know, when you pan back from all of this, and I think the report again speaks eloquently to this, what is at stake are our fundamental values and democracy. And you quoted the sentence that has gotten much well-deserved publicity, which is that torture and democracy cannot peacefully exist in the same body politic. And in the report, you talk about the failure of the various branches of government for various reasons. And we've just witnessed a government shutdown and American public in many ways being held hostage. And I guess my question to you is, as you really pan back from this, what is the future of our democracy?
Oh, boy. Well, I remain an optimist because we have been through these crises before. And I remain optimistic in part because at various times of crisis in our country, good people have come forward to try to provide new opportunities to make change. And while change hasn't taken place as rapidly as we would like, and we are at the moment at the height of what I would call political polarization, particularly in the legislative branch, one can only hope that there are things to move ahead. I, for one, believe redistricting and gerrymandering don't go hand in hand. And we need to find an adequate way to provide assurance to the voters that they will have a choice because the districts are now put together in a way that is coherent, consistent, continuous, and hopefully contestable. And to me, those are the standards that ought to be part of that part of the process. Otherwise, we are, in a sense, producing people who have, in a sense, an endless possibility of running again, and the discouragement of individuals who are in the middle and moderate because they have no choice, and that allows the wings on both sides to dominate the political atmosphere. And if they do, you can't blame the politicians for pandering to the wings.
Yeah.
And so we have a kind of cycle, put it this way, this downward cycle in which institutional change certainly ought to be something we should seriously consider. I think there are wise ways to proceed, and a number of states, including, I understand, this one, are trying to proceed on the basis of a more judicial process after the decennial election, the decennial census, to do the redistricting provided by the conference, by the Congress, and the Constitution.
Well, I fear we have reached the end. I must say that if, as we all know, Ambassador Pickering's resume is incredible, and there are other questions here dealing with all kinds of really, really important issues. I urge you to Google Ambassador Pickering, because you'll find some recent pieces he's written on provocative topics such as Iran, the current state of Israeli affairs, and also the Syrian issues as well. But I fear we're not going to be able to handle all of that tonight. So I want to thank Thomas Pickering, former U.S. Undersecretary of State, former Ambassador to the United Nations, and member of the Constitution Project's Blue Ribbon Panel on Detainee Treatment. You can find a copy of the Constitution Project report, which I urge you to do, at detaineetaskforce.org. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I am Professor Jeffrey Brand of the University of San Francisco School of Law, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.